I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. There has been a dramatic increase in wealth and income for the upper 1% of the U.S. population in the last 30-plus years. The middle class has mostly been treading water over that time, and more people have fallen into poverty in recent years. The mortgage crisis and the Great Recession have hurt those in the middle and bottom of the income ladder especially hard. They haven't benefited from the country's slow-moving recovery the way the wealthy have. Our guest, Timothy Noah, says that income inequality is not just bad for poor people, it's bad for everybody. He tracks how the U.S. became a nation of haves and have-nots and how to fix the problem in his new book called The Great Divergence. Timothy Noah is a columnist, senior editor for The New Republic, joins us from his office. And Timothy Noah, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm interested in the 1% back in 1980 and the 1% that we have today. Did the rich just get richer? Are we talking about a whole new class of rich people when we talk about today's 1%?
We're talking about a greater concentration of the nation's collective income in that top 1% over the last 33 years. You've seen the 1% double its share from about not quite 10% to about 20%. So that's really been a significant change. The payoff to being in the top 1% is significantly higher, and that's part of the Great Divergence story. There are actually two divergences, one of which is the 1% versus the 99%, and the other is a more complex problem having to do with the divide between skilled labor and less skilled labor.
And I want to pick up on both those things, but going back to the 1% and something that you call the financialization of the U.S. economy, I guess is a partial explanation about this great divergence. Explain how this financialization worked.
Well, what you had is a growth of the financial sector in the United States. And steadily less regulation of the financial sector, a movement in investment banks from partnerships to corporations, which has vastly increased the amount of leveraging within the financial sector. Of course, this has brought a great deal of economic insecurity, which we've heard a lot about since 2008, but it also brought about a great deal of economic inequality because the rewards to those who were participating in this financialization were much, much greater, even as the risks were collectivized by the rest of the country.
You say that this great divergence, the title of your book, began under President Jimmy Carter, and it continues under President Obama.
That's right. And they're both Democrats, but
yes.
One point I make is that there's been much more acceleration of income inequality under Republicans than under Democrats. In fact, if you look at the records of Democratic presidents versus Republican presidents going back to 1948, you see pretty different, actually opposite trends, where under Democrats you've seen the greatest income gains at the bottom, and they've tapered off as you go up the income scale. Under Republicans, the biggest income gains have come at the top and have dwindled as you go down the income scale. It's a pretty sort of stark kind of cartoon a version of the stereotype of the difference between Democrats and Republicans, but it seems to be true, with one significant caveat, which is that when we're talking about differences at the very top, Republicans and Democrats have been almost equally hospitable to the 1%.
You write about FDR, the minimum, and also something that he called for. I don't know, this doesn't sound like it was implemented, but the idea of a maximum wage.
Yes, and that just shows you how incredibly different the debate is today from what it was in the 1940s. Yes, FDR said that in addition to being a minimum wage, that in a time of war, that no one should be permitted to have an income above a certain level. And he was not able to get it passed. But the idea that a president could even mention such a thing is really remarkable. While he wasn't able to achieve a maximum wage, the top marginal rate in the United States was 90% in the 40s and 50s, and it didn't really come down until the 1960s when it dropped to 70%, where it remained until Ronald Reagan became president.
And I'm always shocked to read that the upper tax rate for wealthy people in the 1950s was 80 to 90%. Did anyone actually pay that money? That percentage of their income in taxes?
Well again, when we're talking about marginal rates. So we're
right.
talking about the tax rate on all income above a certain level. The thresholds were pretty high. And so that's a consideration. And another consideration is that it is true that there was a certain amount of tax evasion, legal evasion, through various tax breaks and manipulation of the tax code, although that, with much lower rates today, we're certainly no strangers to that ourselves.
Looking at this income inequality that you write about, and as I said in the introduction, it isn't just bad for poor people or people struggling at the lower end of the income scale, but bad for everybody. How does this income gap hurt the whole country?
Excuse me. Well, I would. There have been a number of studies of all sorts of dimensions to income inequality and the ways that it hurts everybody from. Health to even to the environment, although some of the claims for the environmental effects, I think, are a little far-fetched. But if you just look at the economic effects, it seems to me that, you know, we hear that, excuse me, the wealthy need to be, we need to, you know, reward the job creators at the top. But if incentivization works at the top, why doesn't it work in the middle? You've got workers operating at the median, who have seen comparatively small increases in the median income over the course of the Great Divergence. And over the last dozen years or so, the median income has actually gone down slightly. During that period, we've seen huge increases in productivity. And, you know, the grand bargain economically, historically, in the United States was that when productivity increased, that wages increased along with it. That hasn't been happening for the last couple of decades, and during the last dozen years or so, we've actually seen a decline in income as productivity has gone up. It seems to me that when you divorce productivity increases from wages, then you're disincentivizing workers operating at the median, and suddenly middle class people have no great reason to care whether they are more productive in their jobs or not. No great reason to care whether their companies are prospering or not. No great reason to care whether the country is prospering or not. And it's, you know, that's over the long term, I think that's very harmful to the economy.
Because people don't feel as if they get rewarded for their hard work and the productivity that they create.
Exactly.
I'm wondering, too, whether this income gap, this great divergence, as you call it, also creates cultural problems and even psychological, sociological problems, where you end up having people that, in a sense, don't live in the same country, even though they call themselves Americans.
Yes, that's the sociological dimension of the problem and the kind of governance dimension to the problem, is that our politics becomes more tribal. There is a greater sense of separation between economic classes. Interestingly, Charles Murray, a very conservative writer, wrote a book a few months ago called Coming Apart, where he described this in great detail, the growing mutual difference between the affluent and the middle class. They really have become kind of these mutually uncomprehending cultures. They behave in very different ways. They have very little mutual sympathy. And the problem, I think, with Murray's approach is that he doesn't recognize that it has an economic cause. He wants to blame it all in the 60s, which I think is a little silly. But the trend he's describing is real, and it's frightening. I think our politics today are driven to a much greater degree than in the past by resentment of elites, and whether it's, you know, conservative resentment of elites as defined as the cultural elite, or liberal resentment of the economic elite, you know, that is plays a much larger role in our politics than it has before.
And do you think that also sort of explains the very not just negative but highly sort of critical environment that we live in when it comes to politics?
Yes, where both candidates, Democrats and Republicans, and are required to accept as a given that Washington is an inherently corrupt, sort of horrible place, and that the only way one can govern is by keeping it at arm's length. Now, you know, obviously, there's a lot wrong with Washington.
Well, I was going to ask you, is Washington a corrupt and horrible place?
Well, in some ways, but, this was not always, this has not always been the governing view of Washington, D.C. The film Mr. Smith Goes to Washington now, which is kind of a political touchstone, I think, for people across the ideological spectrum. The idea of the, noble Mr. Smith coming to Washington and trying to clean up a corrupt Washington, D.C. is thought of as a very traditional way of regarding Washington. Well, when the movie came out in the 1930s and Frank Capra, the director, brought it to Washington, D.C., members of Congress were outraged that Washington would be portrayed so disrespectfully. I mean, it's really interesting that the kind of prevailing notion of what the task of governance is has become so much more sour. And, actually, I think if anything, if you were to look back on earlier periods, there in many ways government was a lot more corrupt then than it is today.
Well, interestingly, President Obama, I believe, said this morning on one of the TV shows that his greatest regret was, in a sense, not cleaning up Washington and cleaning up that culture.
Yes, and there's plenty that needs cleaning up. But again, I wish that President Obama, instead of bemoaning the fact that he has not cleaned the stables of Washington, I wish he would talk about the fact that he has managed to achieve some positive things in Washington, that he's managed to pass a health care bill, and he's managed to pass a financial reform bill that, while far from perfect, are important down payments on future legislation to achieve social progress. It almost sounds antique to talk about government in this way, but I think part of the problem with the Great Divergence stems from this reluctance to use government in order to improve the situation of middle-class and lower-income people.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll let you clear your voice or get some tea or something, and then we'll be right back talking with Timothy Noah today on Radio Times. He's columnist, senior editor at The New Republic, joins us from his office at The New Republic, and he's the author of a new book called The Great Divergence, America's Growing Inequality Crisis and What We Can Do About It. I want to talk about that skills gap after this very short break. Also, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Please Touch Museum at Memorial Hall in Fairmount Park, the Children's Museum of Philadelphia, supports WHYY. Please Touch Museum offers two full floors of interactive exhibit space, daily theater shows, musical programming, and a century-old refurbished carousel. Families can enjoy the museum's long-standing mission of learning through play. Please Touch Museum is located off I-76 and features on-site parking. PleaseTouchMuseum.org or 215-581-3181.
For her new album, singer Kelly Hogan solicited songs from friends like Robin Hitchcock, Vic Chestnut, and M. Ward.
I feel like the Johnny Appleseed of these songs, so it enables me to go door to door and spread the great songs around.
Kelly Hogan shares some of those great songs live in our studio, this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Recovering from a health crisis might be something you'd like to keep private, but Grammy Award-winning singer Regina Bell says her story could inspire fans.
I'm not scared to talk about it now, because this is huge. I'm a walking miracle.
The incomparable Regina Bell takes fans higher with her new gospel album. That's next time on Tell Me More from NPR News.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and talking with Timothy Noah about his new book called The Great Divergence, America's Growing Inequality Crisis and What We Can Do About It. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Tim, let's talk about this skill divergence, as you call it. Give us an example of what you're talking about.
Well, we talked about the 1% versus the 99%, and that's a pretty simple problem, which is the financialization of the economy and runaway CEO pay. There's a more complex problem happening simultaneously, which is that the divide between skilled labor, which tends to be labor people who have college degrees and increasingly graduate school degrees, versus those who don't, that divide has been growing. And the reason it's been growing is that we have an economy where technological demands are constantly requiring an increase in the skill level of workers, and that happened throughout the 20th century. The 20th century was one technological innovation after another, starting with the advent of electricity. And throughout the 20th century, we saw the skill level of American workers rise and rise and rise to meet that growing demand. Very few people realize that in 1900, fewer than 10% of the population graduated from high school.
Wow.
And within a few decades, we had something called the high school movement, where the states were consciously building high schools, passing laws requiring kids to go to high school. And so within a few decades, we hugely increased the percentage of the population that had a high school degree. And that skill, imparting of skills to the population came at a very fortuitous moment, because we had this acceleration of technology and an acceleration in demand for skilled labor. Well, these two things managed to rise in tandem for most of the 20th century. And then in the 1970s, the high school graduation rate dipped a little bit and then leveled it off. Meanwhile, technological demands continued to increase and increase and increase with the advent of computers. You know, some people think, well, computers were just this revolutionary thing that required skill levels that previously had not been required before. That's not quite right. What happened? They were a continuation of a trend that had been going on throughout the 20th century. But suddenly, we weren't producing workers with the skill levels that could meet that growing demand starting in the 70s. And that supply-demand problem bid up the price of skilled labor relative to unskilled labor. And so that opened up a skill-based divide in incomes. Now, something else that was happening at the same time.
Let me just stop you there just for 1 second. So whereas, let's say, the 1950s, if you could get a high school degree, you probably could get be a high school graduate, you could get a pretty good job. Chances are, as you write, in the 1950s, 40% of workers were in a union or covered by union contracts, that allowed you to have a relatively solid middle-class income. It sounds like with the growing demand for skills and the skill gap, that what, community colleges are taking the place of that high school graduation?
Well, I would say at the beginning of the 20th century, it was high school graduation. By mid-century, you really needed a college degree. By the end of the century, you really needed a graduate degree.
Wow.
Where unions enter into it, was an alternative path. Instead of getting a college degree, you could belong to a union. It was sort of roughly the equivalent of having a college degree, belonging to a union. But what happened in the latter half of the 20th century was that the power of unions in the private sector declined radically. You know, they reached a peak in the early 1950s, when close to 40% of all private sector jobs were covered by union contracts. And today, we're down to about 7% in the private sector. And that's about where we were at the start of the New Deal. The power of unions in order to close that gap is greatly, greatly diminished.
Well, and I interrupted you there, but are you? It sounds like, and having read your book, it sounds like you're saying is that we need to rethink how we educate people so that there's more of a connect between our education system and the skills that we need in order for people to be productive and well paid or relatively well paid employees.
We need to do two things. We need to provide more educated workers, and that's partly by improving our K-12 system. It's partly by getting control over the rising cost of college tuition, which is pricing college out of reach for a lot of people. And but we also need to revive the labor movement. I don't think we're going to make much progress without simultaneously having a labor movement that can defend the interests of middle-skilled workers.
How do you do that? And are you talking about private?
Private, yes. Although it certainly wouldn't hurt to shore up the public sector. When I wrote the book, I took it as a given that the public sector union movement was pretty healthy. But of course, it's been under attack for the last couple of years, and that's really reached a crescendo since I finished my book. But in general, the union movement needs to be shored up, but most especially in the private sector.
But who does that? I mean, is it a matter of sort of recreating a union movement for the 21st century?
Well, you know, a lot of the reason, look, labor movements have been having taking it on the chin around the world because of global competition. But in my book, I really try and focus on the question, why is it so much worse here in the United States? And with regard to unions, there's a very simple explanation, which is that government policy is much more anti-union in the United States than it is in just about any other industrialized democracy. We've seen government turn aggressively against unions since the 1980s, but it really began in 1947 with passage of the Taft-Hartley Law. There was after World War II, there was great fear of post-World War II inflation, and the Republicans retook Congress, and they passed the Taft-Hartley Law at the very moment when unions were just about to reach their historic peak in influence and representation. And Taft-Hartley bill was passed, and it acted as a kind of a slow-acting poison on the labor movement. It took a long time for its effects to be felt, but it seriously inhibited labor's ability to organize and expand. Within a few decades, those effects were really being felt. And to make some progress, we would probably need to repeal some of Taft-Hartley. There have been many, many attempts over the years. The most recent one was the card check bill that was before Congress a few years ago that tried to make it easier to call a union election. You know, we need to increase the penalties on the existing laws. You know, it actually is against the law for an employer to get in the way of an employee who wants to invite in a union. But the penalties are so pathetically slight that it's often been said that it's economically irrational for companies to obey the law. So one suggestion that's been made by some people is to extend civil rights protection to workers who are trying to unionize so that if they are interfered with by their bosses or fired, they can actually turn around and sue their bosses in federal court.
But the union movement has also been hurt by corruption and scandals involving corruption. That hasn't helped the movement either.
That has not helped the movement either. And certainly the behavior of unions in the 1970s and 1980s with the advent of global competition was not helpful. They were adversarial. But, you know, that was really part of a legacy that had been established many decades earlier by management rather than labor. Back when times were good, labor was actually trying to create a more cooperative model in the United States between labor and management along the lines of what developed in Europe. And management very firmly said that they wanted no part of that. I talk at great length in my book about Walter Reuther, who was the American labor leader who I think more than any other tried to establish that. He was president of the United Auto Workers, and he was very interested in making sacrifices for the greater good of both the company and the country. And but in exchange, he wanted unions to have some say in management decisions, and he was told to get lost.
That's Timothy Noah, our guest today on Radio Times. He's senior editor for the New Republic. He's a columnist for the magazine and joins us from their office. And he's the author of a new book called The Great Divergence, America's Growing Inequality Crisis and What We Can Do About It. As you're talking about the union movement, I'm thinking about the deal that was made with the auto industry in the last couple of years and union members giving up some of their good benefits in order to keep the industry going. Even more recently, we had some union members in the studio last week talking about these energy refineries and some of the deals that were worked out to save the refineries and to save some of these jobs. And I wonder whether those two examples are examples of perhaps the kind of cooperation that you're talking about.
They are. You know, some of them may be coming too late, unfortunately. In declining industries, those sorts of givebacks are going to be inevitable. But in growing industries, if you have that spirit of cooperation before an industry starts to decline, you get to realize much more benefit from that spirit of cooperation.
Let's get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We have Darnell from West Philadelphia joining us. And Darnell, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Hello, Marty.
Hi.
Mr. Noah. My point is that I noticed that when the Welfare Reform Act of 1995 took effect after its grace period ending in 2001, that was when the recession began. When the lowest element of our society was eliminated and made poorer, and they stopped spending, that was when the recession began. Immediately after the recession began, Republicans and Democrats wanted us to spend. They kept harping on the message of spending. Ironically, that was when, again, the biggest spenders, the welfare recipients, the buy one, get one free crowd, they stopped spending. And I also think, didn't he invest in our lowest classes, and didn't that trickle up and elevate the whole middle class? And that's my point, keeping it concise.
No, I appreciate that, Darnell. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Tim, you want to respond to that?
Yes, I'm not sure I agree with that. I don't think that welfare reform created the recession. And welfare recipients, I think, do not kind of drive spending in our economy. I think middle-class purchases are much more likely to drive spending. But certainly it is true that welfare reform did not deliver on its promise when we had recessions after its passage, and most particularly during this last recession. We heard a lot about how, there had been a promise with welfare reform that in times of hardship that the rules would be loosened up some, and it didn't really happen. We didn't see much expansion of the welfare rolls commensurate with the economic crisis that came about, and that really the federal government reneged on part of the bargain there, and that was, I think, a terrible thing.
Well, in the last couple of years, though, we're seeing the numbers of people who are poor going up in part as a result of that of the Great Recession, as we call it, of the last couple of years.
Yes, that's right, and the government could have played a more active role in fighting that growth in poverty. That's certainly true. But no, I don't think that welfare reform itself is responsible for the recession. I do, however, think that economic inequality in general does make economic growth more difficult, because the broader point the caller was making is correct, that you need to have somebody out there buying things.
Sure. And that's what drives most of our economy.
Mm-hmm.
People buying
Absolutely.
Things. Jason DePaul had a really fascinating piece in the New York Times yesterday. I won't do justice to it, but it's titled Two Classes Divided by I Do, looking at two women with similar backgrounds, although one of them is married with a husband who works, children. The other is no longer married, raising children as a single mom, and how their lives have diverged, I guess, to use your words, and showing what happens when, and it's not just single parenthood, but if you can't make more than $25,000 a year, it's really hard to move up the mobility ladder.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think there is single parenthood is, you know, obviously it is a problem. You know, when you have two incomes, two parents and two incomes, that's better than one parent and one income. And not as much better, perhaps, as it should be, because male incomes have stagnated significantly and disproportionately over the last 33 years. Nonetheless, it is true that there is a divide that's based on single parenthood versus traditional parenthood. At the same time, though, one objection I would raise to that piece is
sure.
that with respect to what I'm writing about, which is maybe slightly different, I'm writing about the growth in income inequality since 1979. And my understanding of the research is that actually you can't attribute very much of that growth to the rise in single parenthood because the timing doesn't really work out. The rise in single parenthood increased before 1980, and therefore and it hasn't, you know, it actually sort of leveled off for a while. Then it started growing again in the aughts, but it didn't grow very fast in the aughts. And so, as a contributor to the Great Divergence, which again is not the existence of income inequality, but the growth in
right.
income inequality, I would say that single parenthood has not been a major contributor.
But you and others have talked about mobility in the United States. It isn't what it used to be. In fact, I think you say that Canada has more upward mobility than the United States. And so much of the quote-unquote American dream is tied to this notion of upward mobility. What explains this, do you think?
Well, I wasn't able to get this into my book because the research is so new, but there is some growing, you know, not definitive, but suggestive evidence that as income inequality grows, you're going to see less upward mobility. The way it's been described by one scholar at the Brookings Institution is as the rungs of the ladder grow farther apart, the ladder gets harder to climb. And it does seem logical. Alan Krueger, who's the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Obama, he produced a chart last winter that was very interesting. He calls it the Great Gatsby chart, and he plotted mobility, upward mobility, against income inequality, and in countries all over the world, and he kind of looked at what the relationship might be, and he found what seemed to be a rough relationship that as you saw income inequality rise, that you saw mobility slow down.
Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, talking with Timothy Noah about The Great Divergence. That's the title of his book, talking about income inequality, America's growing income inequality crisis, and what we can do about it. He is an editor at The New Republic, and we'll take some more calls after this very short break, 1-888-477-9499. Also, much more to talk about, including what to do about this problem after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Drexel supports WHYY. If you are at least 20 pounds overweight, you may be eligible to participate in a research study called the ENACT Project at Drexel University. This year-long weight loss study is funded by the National Institutes of Health and is designed to help adult men and women lose weight and keep it off without medication. Guidance from weight loss specialists at group meetings is included. For more information, 215-762-8400. 215-762-8400.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Aaron Sorkin, creator and writer of the new HBO series The Newsroom, a backstage drama about a cable news show. Like Sorkin's other shows and movies, The West Wing, The Social Network, and A Few Good Men, there are plenty of verbal fireworks. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. If you've ever had a migraine, you know how incapacitating they are. The characteristic throbbing and pulsing in the head, the stomach upset, and sensitivity to light, to sound, and even smell. Sufferers have two choices: prescription drug treatment or behavioral approaches. On the next Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, we'll discuss headaches, their crippling effects, and the latest on treatment. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. The widening income gap in the U.S. is not new. Our guest, Timothy Noah, says it began under Carter, continues under Obama. He diagnoses this phenomenon, offers a number of solutions to the problem in his new book called The Great Divergence. He writes about the financialization of the economy, advances in technology, immigration, outsourcing, the skills gap, and labor unions. And Noah is a columnist, senior editor at The New Republic, covered politics for about 30 years. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Joe from Conshohocken to join us on Radio Times. And Joe, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Just a question.
Sure.
You did mention the impact of the less power of unions and skill levels it being a problem in advancing the middle class and workers. But what about the education gap that seems to also be arising? How do we address that very important point and raise the literacy levels and the science and math levels in our education system so that workers are really prepared for modern growth jobs?
Joe, it's a good question. Those are those STEMs, science, technology, something, engineering, and mathematics. Tim, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I think that, you know, we just need to improve our education system generally, and we need to make it more affordable. In my book, I actually call for a government controls on college tuition increases, which seemed incredibly radical when I wrote this sentence in my book. But then I sent my manuscript off, and I sat down when the book was at the printers, not yet back, and watched the State of the Union address, and I saw that President Obama, in much more euphemistic language, called for much the same thing. He said that the government was going to put colleges and universities on notice, that if they couldn't get tuition increases under control, that the feds would use their spending leverage in order to make them get it under control. So I think that, you know, making college tuition more affordable is an important piece. I think improving K-12 education generally is an important piece. And one piece that is actually not very controversial and but still hasn't happened is that we need to increase pre-K education. Everybody I know has started educating their kids at the age of three by sending them to preschool. And yet, I think the percentage nationwide of kids who get pre-K education is, I think it's less than 40%.
Wow.
And that's appalling. I mean, we need to do for preschool today what we did for high school education in the early part of the 20th century. We need to make it universal. All the research shows that early education has a huge impact on the quality of learning later on.
Well, and I'm assuming when you say everyone you know, you mean people like yourself, educated professionals who are sending their children to early childhood education programs.
That's right. The affluent, if it's good enough for the affluent, right, it should be good enough for everybody.
And I saw somewhere where you referred to yourself as being in the upper 10% of the income strata.
Yes, it's funny. I just gave an interview to Brooklyn Rail, and they sort of asked me, "Well, you know, what are you?" And I said, "Well, I guess I have to say I'm rich because I'm in the top 10%." And most people I know who are in the top 10% would turn pale at the thought of describing themselves as rich. And certainly, I am not rich compared to lots of other people. I am not in the in the 1%, or even I think in the 5%. But we need to recognize that it's a great thing in a way that everybody in America thinks of themselves as middle class, because it does promote an idea of social equality that in many respects is healthy. But at the same time, there is a kind of obliviousness among people who are in that top 10%. They think of themselves as put upon middle class people who shouldn't have to pay more in taxes, who are, you know, victims in various ways, and they are not. They are doing quite well, and they need to recognize that and to turn more of attention, more of their attention to the plight of people who are making less than that, and think harder about ways in which to create greater income equality.
Well, speaking of taxes, as we know, President Obama has talked about increasing taxes for those making more than $250,000. You even call, I saw an article that to raise taxes on the middle class. Just to underscore this, federal taxes, I think, are as low as they've been in the last 50 years or so. Do we pay too little taxes, meaning most people or most middle class people or that upper 10% of people?
Yes. I mean, I wrote this whole book about various ways in which the middle class is getting socked, and that's certainly true. Taxation is not one of them. Taxes have gone down and down and down across the board. And what I think is that certainly in facing the challenges in the future of bringing down the deficit and also using the government to address social problems that it needs to address, that everybody's going to have to pay more in taxes. And I think the middle class will have to pay more in taxes. But I think that people at the top should pay a lot more in taxes, because we need to be able to demonstrate that they are paying their fair share. And the one kind of piece of this story that the Democrats are not really coming clean about is that you can't really get there just by raising taxes at the top. But what you can do is you can make taxation at the top much more progressive in order to demonstrate to the country that when everybody's taxes go up, that it's being done so in a way that's fair.
In fact, you talk about creating new tax brackets. New tax brackets for those upper income people.
Yes, yes. I think that there should be. I think we should return to the Clinton era levels, as President Obama says, but that we should also create new tax brackets at $1 million, $10 million, maybe even $20 million, and that the top marginal rate should rise to 70% as it was as recently as 1980. The thing about, when President Obama talks about, extending the Bush tax cuts for the middle class, I think it probably is a good idea for the short term because of the weak recovery that we're going through right now. I think that we do need some stimulus, and particularly, I think stimulus for the middle class will do the most to help the economy to recover. But what people tend to forget, first of all, he's going all the way up to $250,000, which sort of puts you very comfortably in the top 5%. So to call those people middle class is a bit of a reach. Plus, he's talking about marginal rates. So, when extending the Bush tax cuts in the manner that Obama is suggesting, while it will certainly be very beneficial to the middle class, will actually also bestow great benefits on people at incomes all the way up to $1 million, because they will still be paying lower taxes on their incomes up to $250,000, so it's not just people whose incomes are below $250,000 who will benefit from that. Actually, there's a bigger benefit in terms of dollars to people at incomes above $250,000 a year.
And that's one thing I think people don't understand. I've heard this time and time again, where when there's talk about increasing the federal taxes or taxes for the federal government, that people think that whole $250,000 is going to be taxed at that higher rate. It's really the money that you make above that $250,000 that's taxed at that higher rate.
Yes, there was this amazing story last week where Tim Geithner had to go up to Capitol Hill to explain this to a bunch of Democratic members of Congress. Mm-hmm. You would think members of Congress would be clear on this.
But
yes. No, the marginal rates, the way our tax system works is that you pay a certain percentage on income up to a certain level, mm-hmm. and then when you get above that level, you pay a higher percentage, and then you know, when you get to another threshold, you pay a higher percentage. Still, you aren't, these percentages are not applied to all of your income. They're only applied to that portion of your income that exceeds the level where the bracket begins.
I'm looking at some of your other recommendations, including more sort of WPA job programs that are funded by the federal government. Do you think there's appetite for that now?
No, but you know, when I wrote my kind of what is to be done chapter.
Yes.
I really made a conscious decision that, you know, this is a problem that's been a third of a century in the making. And there really isn't much point in talking about solutions. There's not much point in talking only about solutions or even mostly about solutions that are politically achievable today, because there's not a lot that's politically achievable today. And, you know, it took a third of a century for this problem to reach the point it's at now. It's going to take a while to reverse it, and I think we need to think in terms of the long term, mm-hmm. and if you really want to solve the problem, then I think we need to start talking about more ambitious solutions that of course are not going to clear Congress in the next 6 months.
And do you have a hope or even belief that our political system can fix itself to address some of these problems we've been talking about?
Yes, I do, actually. For a number of reasons. One is simply that, you know, there is more discussion and more interest in this problem than has existed for the third of the century that this problem has been growing. The Great Divergence is 33 years old, and it really wasn't until the last year that it was a topic of major national discussion. You had the Occupy movement. You had the media looking at it much more extensively than ever before. You had the president talking about it much more than ever before. You had a chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers who was issuing reports about it. I mean, this is really unprecedented stuff. I'm not saying that guarantees that we will see action, but there, I think, it's certainly true. There is more reason today to be hopeful than there ever was before, and some of the solutions that are being discussed. As I said, I thought this notion of imposing government controls on college tuition was horribly radical, but President Obama proposed it in the State of the Union. There was no pushback from Republicans, because I have a couple of theories about that. One is that I don't think Republicans are terribly fond of colleges and universities, as Rick Santorum let us know during the primaries when he called Obama a snob for wanting everybody to go to college. And another thing is that, you know, conservative and Republican members of Congress, they've got kids, too. They want to send their kids to college, too. And they're as aware of, as anybody else is, of the really uncontrollable nature of rising tuition increases. College tuition today, after you figure in inflation, it costs about twice what it cost at the start of the Great Divergence, which is really amazing to me.
Amazing and shocking. I also think those stories of college graduates, you know, looking for work and saddled with $50,000 worth of college debt or $100,000 or even more, that those stories, those anecdotes were very, very powerful example of why the system needs to be fixed.
Yes, there's a great deal of interest. It's funny, the New York Times had a few pieces about this last month, and one of them they looked at Ohio State, where the president of Ohio State was very engaged in this question of how we control rising tuition costs, and the reporter found out that the president of Ohio State makes $2 million a year. It's the highest paid university president in the country. And, you know, we asked him, well, you know, wouldn't that be a good place to start? And he said, well, no, of course not.
That's infuriating, I have to say. That's infuriating, I have to say.
It's completely infuriating. And it came out in this piece that Ohio State has a its own airport and two golf courses. So as I was reading this, I was thinking, you know, I thought this was going to be a difficult problem. Maybe this problem is a little easier to solve than I thought it was.
Well, let me give you one more thing, and this may be hard to solve, and we're almost out of time here, but one of the other things you say is to treat capital gains like regular income. First of all, do you think that's doable?
Yes. I mean, you know, Ronald Reagan did it in the 1980s. People think that it's this, you know, wild-eyed liberal idea, but it was part of the 1986 tax reform that was put forth by mm-hmm. President Ronald Reagan. And so if it's good enough for Ronald Reagan, it seems to me it ought to be good enough for today's Democrats, certainly, and maybe even today's Republicans.
But why isn't it?
Well, there's a huge amount of resistance, a huge amount of, you know, the Republican Party is more extreme than it was under Ronald Reagan today. But, you know, there's also a lot of pushback. It was very interesting to me when we saw the scandal with J.P. Morgan Chase a couple of months ago, I saw in both the National Review and the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal op-ed pieces by conservatives saying that we need to break up the big banks, which is one of the things I call for in my book as well. There's a lot of pushback among conservatives against the situation on Wall Street today.
Well, on that note, Timothy Noah, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. He's senior editor for The New Republic, author of this new book we've been talking about called The Great Divergence, America's Growing Inequality Crisis and What We Can Do About It. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.